Welcome to KDNK's Weekly Newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywax Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgebel. Open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywax.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Governor Jared Polis has issued a statewide mask order for everyone older than 10, reports Colorado Politics. During a press conference this afternoon, Polis said, quote, "The party has to end if we want businesses to open and save lives," end quote. In addition to masking up in the grocery store or restaurants, masks will be required in all offices, lobbies, elevators, indoor businesses, common areas, gyms, and while getting a haircut or a massage. State epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said the rate of cases and the rate of hospitalizations are on the rise, reflected by the R-naught number. An R-naught number less than 1 means one person infects fewer than one other person. Colorado's number is now between 1.6 and 1.8, up from 1.3 a week ago. The governor added that the state has a few ways to enforce the new order. One is a trespassing charge if someone refuses to wear a mask into a business, and businesses must also follow the protocol to keep their licenses. The governor put a pause on variances granted to counties for opening businesses and allowing events of more than 10 people.
Surges of coronavirus nationwide are stressing the supply chain for testing components and overloading state and commercial lab capacity. This means some test results have been delayed up to 8 days. Regional public health officials aim to tackle this issue with a coordinated strategy. Their goal is to improve testing availability and decrease turnaround times to a maximum of 48 hours. Testing is recommended for people with symptoms, including fever, cough, or shortness of breath, close contacts of confirmed COVID-19 cases, especially those in high-risk categories like 65 and older, people who are immunocompromised, or who have chronic illness like heart disease or asthma. Officials also recommend testing for people in congregate settings where there may be broader exposure to the virus, as defined by a local public health agency. More information on regional COVID-19 testing is available on Garfield, Eagle, and Pitkin County websites. You can also find links at kdnk.org.
COVID-19 cases are also increasing locally. According to the State Department of Public Health, Eagle County is the fifth highest in the state for confirmed cases per 100,000 people at 15,002. Pitkin County is 15th highest with 828 cases overall per 100,000 people, and Garfield County comes just behind Pitkin with 824 cases per 100,000 people. 178 cases were confirmed between June 20th and July 17th in Garfield County, with a major spike between June 29th and July 5th. 64 cases were reported that week. The past 4 weeks have seen more cases in Garfield County than any other time since the pandemic began, according to county records. 24 new cases were recorded on July 17th alone. A little over 33% of the cases are from Glenwood Springs, 19.2% from Carbondale, with Rifle at 15.4%. 4 COVID-19 deaths have been reported in Garfield County since the onset of the pandemic, including one last week, 2 in Pitkin County and 9 in Eagle County. Here's more about local efforts to corral the virus. It's called Box It In. That's what Pitkin County health officials have dubbed the newest strategy for fighting COVID-19. It's not really new information. It's a new explanation of how to use what we've got until a vaccine comes along. In a community meeting Thursday, Pitkin County epidemiologist Josh Vance says that it starts with isolating the sick, quarantining those who have been exposed to the virus, and testing.
When someone gets tested and they test positive, we get informed of that result here at the health department. Our role is to contact those individuals who have a confirmed case of COVID-19 and ensure that they remain isolated until they are no longer infectious.
General isolation, usually at home, lasts about 10 days. Then the contact tracing begins. Health officials find out if there is anyone who has had contact with the person who is sick. Those people are asked to self-quarantine. Why? Because they might not know they have the virus.
The tricky thing about COVID-19 is people don't always know they have it. There's a lot of asymptomatic individuals. And so when we have identified that somebody might be exposed, we're going to call and we're going to state that quarantine is needed for 14 days just to ensure that this doesn't spread.
Then the cycle continues. If a quarantined person develops symptoms, they need to get tested and self-isolate. Those who came in contact with that person need to self-quarantine and so forth.
And this is really our best method at containing this virus. We don't have a vaccine right now. We don't have good treatment. We have antivirals, but we don't have the means to really prevent it.
It takes 2 to 14 days from exposure to the virus for symptoms to appear, which explains the 14-day quarantine period. So why not wait on the quarantine until after symptoms develop?
And the reason why we ask people to quarantine even when they're feeling okay is because people with COVID-19 can be infectious while they don't yet have symptoms and are actually most infectious right before you develop symptoms. You might be feeling fine. You might feel like you don't have any symptoms. You may not feel like you have the virus, but you may actually be the most contagious at that point. So that's why we request that 14-day quarantine from the last day that you were exposed to ensure that you're not accidentally or inadvertently spreading the virus.
Vance said contact tracing is imperative for slowing community spread of the virus. A recent study published in the Lancet Medical Journal showed that contact tracing and quarantine before symptom onset reduced transmission of COVID-19 when the R-naught number was around 1.5. The R-naught number measures how many people one person with the virus can infect. At a press conference in Denver Thursday, Colorado's epidemiologist said that the state's R-naught number is now between 1.6 and 1.8. The study published in The Lancet showed that controlling an outbreak becomes more difficult when the R-naught reaches 2.5 and transmissions occur before symptom onset. In other words, containing the virus by boxing it in with testing, isolation, quarantine, and contact tracing works.
We continue to be cautious with regard to the amount of testing that we're doing.
Dave Ressler is CEO of Aspen Valley Hospital.
We are exceeding the 16 tests per day, which was established as the threshold, at which point we moved from comfortable to cautious. And we've been there now for about a week. When we increased or surpassed that threshold of 16, we actually doubled our capacity to 32 and are open on the weekend as well for symptomatic people requiring testing.
He said that testing is available at hospitals throughout the Tri-County area. But unless someone is hospitalized to manage COVID symptoms, a referral from a primary physician must come first. He added that AVH can help if someone has neither doctor nor insurance.
We do not want any barriers at all to getting a referral for the testing.
Josh Vance said non-compliance with quarantine or isolation is a problem.
There's two main things here. One is unwillingness to quarantine. And so when we call somebody stating that they've been exposed, it means that we have reason to believe that they've been exposed. And so we ask them to quarantine for that period of time. We're not calling just anyone to ask them to quarantine. We're asking people that have been exposed to quarantine because we believe that they may have the infection. So we really need compliance with quarantine. And then the second thing is, when we call, we expect a call back. We have important information to share. We want to inform you that you may have the virus. You may be inadvertently spreading the disease, and we want to ensure that, we can ask you to quarantine. So really the best method we have right now to return to normal is to box it in.
Garfield County saw two COVID-19 deaths in less than 2 weeks this month. And a statewide mask mandate went into effect on July 17th because Colorado cases are spiking. But it remains to be seen if residents will comply to keep the virus at bay. The rise of COVID-19 cases locally is affecting the Latino demographic with notable prominence. KDNK's Raleigh Burley has more on why this might be.
Between June 15th and June 28th, Garfield County saw a spike of nearly 100 lab-confirmed and probable cases of COVID-19. Consistent with trends across the country, minority populations were affected at a rate that is disproportionately higher than their fraction of the overall local population.
COVID-19 is truly hitting the Latino community really, really hard.
That's Beatrice Soto, founding board member of Voces Unidas de las Montañas. She spoke at a virtual meeting hosted by the City of Glenwood Springs on June 30th.
And we're really starting to feel and see the social inequities in our systems and in our communities.
66 additional cases have since been recorded, further emphasizing this discrepancy, with 60% of total cases in Garfield County occurring among Latinos as of this past Sunday. Comparatively, Latinos represent only about 30% of the population of Garfield County, according to Voces Unidas. Speaking with KDNK News, Garfield County Public Health Specialist Carrie Godis shared that contact tracing links recent clusters of cases to carpooling as well as work conditions.
You know, if you're riding in a car with someone and you're going to work or you're going to a social outing, and that person is asymptomatic but then later test positive and you've been exposed, we've had that happen. And then that person that rides with that person brings that back on home to their family, passes it to a spouse, it's passed it to children, and those children have interaction with grandparents, and suddenly we really see a lot of spread from those kind of situations. We've also seen it in job sites.
Godis suggests that patrons be considerate of workers while visiting businesses.
When we interact at our restaurants and our grocery stores, you know, they're masking up for us, and you know, they're masking up all day. They're masking up for 8, 9-hour, 10-hour days of work for us. We need to do that courtesy back to them of just covering up for that 30-minute trip into the grocery store to protect them. So I think that that has also contributed to some of our Hispanic population just being exposed through on the job and then social situations.
Another possible factor shared by Godis is the social warmth characteristic of Latin cultures, as well as living conditions that more commonly include extended and multiple families.
Our Hispanic outreach coordinator will tell you they're also, you know, a very loving, very social, community-oriented group just by kind of the virtue of their culture. And so that is also a message that we need to convey, how we can be still together, but just with some distance.
Moreover, immigrant populations have been significantly more pressured to work during this public health crisis without the same governmental assistance as U.S. citizens, like unemployment benefits or receiving a stimulus check. The necessity of risking infection to maintain an income is a consequence of systemic inequality. Still, a survey released by Voces Unidas in early July found that among 84 Latino respondents living in the area, 70% were without work and income as of May 22nd, and only 5% were able to continue working since the beginning of the pandemic.
Our data also shows that some Latinos don't know what to do necessarily if somebody in their family does contact the virus and how to protect the broader community.
Solutions offered by Voces Unidas include that all official public information from counties be linguistically and culturally effective and disseminated to all communities at the same time via effective channels. Additionally, all employers should distribute culturally effective information in Spanish and English to all of their workers on what to do if an employee is experiencing COVID-19 symptoms, while highlighting their rights and protections as workers. For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
You're listening to the Weekly News Reel, featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. More info at grassrootstv.org.
The National Park Service is reevaluating how it manages Yellowstone's bison. The last management review was done in the early 2000s. Camila Kadelska takes a look at what is at stake.
The Yellowstone National Park bison herd is managed by the Interagency Bison Management Plan. It includes state, federal, and tribal agencies. It maintains the free-ranging bison at around 3,000 within the park. It does that by transferring some of the animals outside of the park after quarantining them for 2 years to ensure they're disease-free. Some animals are used for state and tribal sanctioned hunts. Others are slaughtered. Irvin Carlson is the president of the Intertribal Buffalo Council Board.
Our biggest interest, ITBC, is that of transferring these animals to out to tribes and not to slaughter. We want to see the increase of these animals of in a greater area.
The National Park Service said it intends to have its new plan in 2 years. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Camila Kadalska.
This week, Americans are celebrating their national forests. Ute Mountain Utes member Regina Lopez-Whiteskonk says forests have long been places where indigenous people have retreated to find solitude or collect herbs in preparation for ceremonies. She says access to public lands has been especially important during the pandemic.
Indigenous people have always found refuge in the mountains. The mountain and the forest areas have always been very important places to center and heal.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's management planning efforts are underway for the Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, and Gunnison National Forests in western Colorado. Lopez-Whiteskonk says she hopes the agency will consider the wisdom of indigenous stewardship practices to ensure that the area's rich wildlife and natural vegetation are preserved for generations to come. Arvin Ramgulam owns a hybrid bookstore and coffee shop in Crested Butte. He says he hopes the revised plan will do a better job balancing extraction with needs of the outdoor recreation industry. Ramgulam says he'd like to see as much of the forest's natural beauty protected as possible, which he views as critical for businesses in gateway towns.
It's an inexhaustible resource for us to return to all the time, but we have to take care of it, and we have to have rules and things in place that make it so we can sustainably use it and use it responsibly.
National forests are public lands owned by all Americans, but they have not been enjoyed equally. Non-Hispanic whites tend to dominate, while people of color and communities with less education and income are less likely to participate in outdoor recreation. The USDA plans to submit an environmental impact statement for its current draft plan for the forests for public comment in the next year. For KDNK, I'm Eric Galatis.
There are only 5 oil and gas rigs listed as operating in Colorado over the last 3 weeks. It's the first time in 20 years that the energy services company Baker Hughes has counted fewer than 15 active rigs in the state. U.S. oil output fell to a record low recently. The pandemic has cut demand and prices for oil. Prices fell so much that drilling isn't economically feasible. And 5,000 jobs have been cut from the mining sector in Colorado, which is among the hardest hit industries. I'm Ben Marcus, CPR News.
One of the top stories on KDNK's website this week is a conversation between KVNF's Jody Peterson and the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel's Dennis Webb about what's going on with the Bureau of Land Management now that it's moved headquarters to Grand Junction.
Last July, the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, announced that it would be moving most of its staff from Washington, D.C. to various western states, including a relocation of its headquarters to Grand Junction. The Trump administration argued that most of the public land that the BLM oversees is located in the West, so the agency should be too. In Colorado, the BLM manages about 8 million acres for grazing, recreation, and other uses. Plus, it administers another 27 million acres of mineral estate, including oil and gas. But the BLM's move has been controversial, as the agency took 200-some positions that were based in Washington, D.C., and distributed them to locations in western states. Critics see the move as an attempt to weaken the agency and give industry more sway on public lands. The BLM has struggled to fill leadership positions in its new Grand Junction headquarters. Only 17 of the 41 jobs there have been filled, some with career BLM officials, some with transfers from other agencies. Also controversial has been the agency's interim director, William Perry Pendley, who has said he doesn't believe the federal government should own lands. President Trump has now nominated Pendley to be the permanent director of the agency, but his confirmation by the Senate faces many obstacles. KVNF spoke with Grand Junction Sentinel reporter Dennis Webb about the BLM's attempt to staff up its new Grand Junction headquarters. Webb has reported extensively on the story and says that many staffers chose not to make the move west.
The majority of those people were not wanting to make a move, and it's hard to know exactly how many people who were top-level people that were in D.C. won't be in Junction. Those people aren't going to move, but clearly they are bringing in a lot of new people, and I think for people who are concerned about a brain drain in terms of losing senior BLM people, I think probably some of that is occurring. Penley and we'll continue to argue that they were having trouble filling a lot of senior positions in Washington because high housing costs and long commute times and people not really wanting to live there. He makes that counter argument that there's more appeal to people wanting to work out of the West, locations like Grand Junction. Certainly the critics of the move do worry, but there has been some loss of institutional knowledge.
William Perry Penley has been acting director of the BLM for a year now, but has never been officially confirmed. Conservation groups have filed a lawsuit alleging that his continued reappointments during the past year are a violation of federal law.
There was actually legal action brought, I think, sometime this spring, challenging under a couple of different laws, saying that he just lacked the basic qualifications to even serve in an acting capacity, and at some point arguing that he had exceeded the 210 days that the law allowed. And then meanwhile, Penley now has been formally nominated by President Trump to be BLM director, which the president had not nominated anybody for the job during his presidency. So it's been this succession of acting directors over the years. So the legal challenge continues over whether he can be acting director as this nomination is pending. And there's certainly something of a question mark about if the votes are going to be there in the Senate to confirm him. To some degree, a pretty controversial choice.
Penley has been a strong advocate of the idea of selling or transferring federal public lands to private or state ownership. And his views on racial inequality and social justice are dismaying to most observers. Penley has publicly dismissed the Black Lives Matter movement as based on a lie and endangering both police and citizens.
He's an attorney that was president of the Mountain State Legal Foundation, a pretty conservative group, and he took a number of positions on public land issues that his critics aren't happy with, and those are the kinds of things that are going to come up in a confirmation hearing.
Some U.S. senators have already said they won't support Penley's nomination, including one from Colorado.
Senator Bennett here in Colorado already says he won't be supporting confirmation. I know Joe Manchin, the senator back east, a moderate Democrat, has indicated that he won't be as well. And I think the question is what Republicans will be doing. Cory Gardner has kind of taking a wait-and-see approach. He's not saying too much.
Even if Penley does make it through the confirmation process, his tenure won't outlast the Trump administration. If Joe Biden is elected this fall, he'll get to nominate his own slate of directors for more than 50 federal agencies, including the BLM.
There's a ticking clock as far as that election and what happens if there's a new administration. I think it's probably pretty safe to say they would be looking in a different direction when it comes to who they'd want to head the BLM.
And that was the Grand Junction Sentinel's Dennis Webb.
The BLM is also coming under fire from conservationists.
Mark Richardson of the Colorado News Connection has more.
Colorado conservation groups are calling on the U.S. Senate to reject the nomination of William Perry Penley for director of the Federal Bureau of Land Management. They claim Penley, who's been acting head of the BLM for the past year, has a history of promoting the sale of public lands. He previously was president of the Mountain States Legal Foundation. Suzanne O'Neill with the Colorado Wildlife Federation says Penley's ultra-conservative anti-government values make him unqualified for the job.
His philosophy over 30-plus years has been very consistent. It's held firm, and it's not favoring federal management of public lands. He believes they should be in private hands.
In a letter to senators, the National Wildlife Federation and its affiliates in 12 western states called for lawmakers to vote against the nomination. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt touted Penley's years in federal land management as ample qualification to hold the job. O'Neill says since coming to the BLM, Penley has single-mindedly advocated for the sale of oil and gas leases and has neglected other aspects of the agency's mission.
You've got energy, you've got grazing, you've got recreation, wildlife conservation, etc. And it's a difficult balancing act, but the leader needs to really believe in balancing and have that messaging flow through to his state directors and others.
O'Neill says her biggest misgiving regarding Pendley is a list of 60 former clients he submitted before taking the interim job. Although he promises to recuse himself from dealing with any of them, she says they pose an insurmountable barrier to even-handedly performing his duties.
How can you be an effective leader when you have so many conflicts of interest? We're looking for balance and just can't fathom how someone with that track record, philosophy, and conflicts can bring balance at this very important time.
She says if Pendley is confirmed, Colorado's 22 million acres of public lands would be in danger of disappearing. Senators have not yet scheduled a vote on the nomination. For Colorado News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
U.S. Senator Michael Bennett was in western Colorado this week. KVNF's Gavin Dahl met up with him in Hotchkiss. Here's a clip about public lands and the Colorado Outdoor Recreation Economy, or CORE Act, which is gaining traction in Congress, but not quite enough.
You've championed public lands throughout your time in Washington, voted recently for the Great American Outdoors Act, which passed in the U.S. Senate, expected to pass out of the House next week. Along these lines, you've been advocating for the CORE Act. Why are you in favor of it, and why didn't the Republicans who control the Senate include it in that last
year? Yeah, so I wish that they had included it. The CORE Act is the result of 10 years of work. It's had the most extensive public outreach of any public lands bill in modern history in Colorado. Every single county that is touched by the CORE Act supports the CORE Act, and that's county commissioners that are Republicans and Democrats. And it has broad bipartisan support across the state. We would protect 400,000 acres of public land. Almost all of that is protecting the existing uses on that land. 70,000 acres would be wilderness that would protect watersheds that we have to protect on our highest peaks. And it, among other things, creates the first national historic landscape at Camp Hale, which is, where our bravest soldiers were trained to go over to Italy and fight, and they did successfully. Then they came back to Camp Hale, and they started our outdoor recreation industry. They started our ski mountains, and literally their skis, their surplus skis, became the beginning of skiing in Colorado. And I think it's very important for us to memorialize that. So I don't know of any public lands bill that has more support at the local level than it was written in community meetings, just like the one I had on the ground in Colorado. It's disappointing to me that it wasn't included in this package, but I believe that we will get it passed, and when we do, it'll not just be great for our cultural attachment to public lands, it's going to be a great economic driver for Colorado.
And finally, in honor of next week's 49th annual Mountain Fair, KDNK's Mountain Fair Memory Machine presents Barbara Bush's Fireball Story.
My name is Barbara Bush. I have been around since about the second Mountain Fair in 1972. There was a Friday night when we were all set up and getting things rolling, and we had the music and the bands were there and the park was all together and the beer was flowing at the beer at the I think it was still just the KDNK beer tent back then. There was the transformer blew up right across the street from the park, and it was the most amazing purple flash explosion that ran up the power line, and that was it. We had no power. There was no power to the park, and it was probably my favorite Friday night because everybody just stood around and talked and told stories. And people just played acoustic music, played acoustically. And it was one of my favorite true community events for Mountain Fair. And all it took was us turning off the power and celebrating each other just face-to-face, one-on-one. Luckily, of course, we didn't need electricity for the beer to flow. But there you go. There you have it. That is Carbondale.
Do you have a favorite Mountain Fair memory that you'd like to share with our community? Well, some say if you can remember, you weren't there, but we know you have stories. You can record a message with KDNK's Mountain Fair Memory Machine by calling 970-510-3250.
That number once again is 970-510-3250. Do you have your own memory to share about the infamous fireball? Call us now.
That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at kdnk.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening and have a great week.